turned and saw a man who looked like a younger version of her XO. Only the eyes, hard and cold, suggested he was actually the older brother. His gaze flickered over her once, then locked onto her eyes, a motion that warned her it would be dangerous to underestimate Scott McElney. The shirt she'd found was a size too tight, but he hadn't even looked at her breasts, just her eyes. He wasn't going to underestimate her.
"You must be Catherine Falcone," Scott said.
He held out a hand.
"It is a pleasure to meet an aristocrat who actually gets her hands dirty from time to time."
"Thank you," Kat said. She shook his hand and then allowed him to motion her towards a bench in a private compartment.
"How many aristocrats have you met?"
Scott tapped his nose, but said nothing. The XO leaned forward.
"This isn't a friendly chat," he said.
His voice was tense, as if he hadn't wanted to have company when he spoke to his brother.
"The last time we met, you mentioned navigational data. Do you have such data on hand?" "I have quite a bit of data on hand," Scott said.
"What
precisely are you looking for?"
"Unguarded routes into the theocracy," Kat said. "A way to slip into their space without being detected."
"I have several," Scott said. "Some safer than others, but more likely to attract attention."
He paused.
"But what are you prepared to pay?"
Kat exchanged a glance with her XO, then reached into her pocket and produced a blank credit chip. She held it up so he could read the balance, zero, then pressed the coin into the palm of her hand, using her implants to authorize the transfer. The credit balance jumped up to 1,000 crowns. And it would be largely untraceable, she was sure. The crowns would still exist, but they would no longer be connected to her.
1,000 crowns up front, she said. She sensed her XO's shock, but pressed on anyway. There was no time to bargain.
"And I will pay another 1,000 crowns upon our successful return."
"You could be caught, or reveal the existence of the passageway," Scott said smoothly. "I dare say it won't remain a secret after you report it back to Tyre."
Kat suspected he was right, but she also knew he was trying to see how much she was prepared to pay. "I will put the other 1,000 crowns in an escrow account," she said shortly. "If we don't make it back, the Board of Inquiry will determine the cause of our deaths. The account will then be unlocked if the problem isn't with your directions."
"And if it is," she added silently, "there will be a number of hard questions for you." "It sounds like a decent offer," Scott said.
"But what happens if the theocracy starts guarding the passageway?"
"They haven't started guarding it yet, even though you've probably used it yourself," the XO grated. His voice was very cold. "They could start guarding it tomorrow or from the moment the war breaks out."
"True," Scott agreed.
"But I do have commitments."
Kat studied him for a long moment, then sighed. "I will put 2,000 crowns in the escrow account," she said. "It will be released to you upon our safe return, no further questions asked. And we shall do our best to remain undetected."
"Very well," Scott said. 1,000 now, 2,000 afterwards. "And you will add a guarantee of secrecy," the XO added. "You're not allowed to trade anything you might have picked up today to anyone else."
Kat swore inwardly. She'd grown up among the aristocracy, and she'd never considered the possibility of betrayal, but it was far too possible. The smugglers lived in the void between the two interstellar powers, trying to play each of them off against the other. Scott might be loyal enough to his brother not to consider betraying him to the theocracy, but there was no way they could take it for granted.
"Very well," Scott said. "You will have exclusivity."
He reached into his pocket, produced a data chip, and pressed it against his palm. There was a long pause as he worked silently, then removed the chip and passed it to Kat. She took it and scanned it with her own implants, discovering that there were 5 navigational files on the chip, and nothing else. After a moment, she passed him the credit chip and pocketed his data chip. The smuggler smiled and rose to his feet.
"One moment," the XO said. "What else have you heard about recent events?"
"Not much," Scott said.
"For once, the Admiral's office is very quiet. It's quite suspicious."
"Good," Kat said. "Let us hope it stays that way." William couldn't help brooding as they made their way back to the shuttle, then flew into orbit and returned to Lightning. His brother was a disgrace, both to the family and his entire homeworld. There was no avoiding the fact he'd made his fortune smuggling everything from guns to farming equipment, and probably slaves. William had no illusions about life on primitive farming worlds. There was no shortage of worlds that would be grateful if smugglers shipped in young boys and girls, children who could be taught how to farm, or equipment they simply couldn't afford for themselves. He wondered briefly what the captain had thought of Scott, but she hadn't said a word to him. Instead, she seemed almost meditative, perhaps contemplating the task ahead of their ship. Even if the navigational data was as good as Scott clearly believed, it would be difficult to sneak across the border without being detected. But they had no choice. Orders were orders. And besides, if they discovered an attack fleet preparing to launch, it would wake up the Commonwealth to the oncoming storm. "I need you to review this data," the captain said as they entered the navigational compartment. Lieutenant Nicola Robertson was sitting inside, studying the latest update from the weathermen. "If this is a safe course to use, we need to depart this afternoon." Lieutenant Robertson took the chip and slipped it into a reader. "Not a standard piece of navigational data," she noted. "Can I ask where it came from?"
"No,"
William growled. The captain shot him a look, but said nothing.
"Interesting," Lieutenant Robertson said.
"This course would take us right through the Seven Sisters." William swore.
"The bastard."
The captain leaned forward. "But is it usable?" Lieutenant Robertson hesitated.
"If the data is accurate, there is a passage through the region," she said.
"But it wouldn't be a very safe passage. I'd honestly not recommend sending an entire fleet through in a body, and a handful of mines could be used to close the passage permanently."
William studied the display, thinking. The Seven Sisters, 7 stars that orbited each other, projected an odd gravitational pattern into hyperspace. Smart navigators deemed the entire area impassable and refused to go anywhere near it. But smugglers would probably consider it an ideal place to meet and transfer stolen cargoes in private. They could be almost assured of avoiding detection, even by border patrol ships. The sheer level of hyperspace distortion made any form of patrolling almost impossible.
"It might be doable," he said reluctantly. "But it will be very risky, Captain. A single mistake and we might be forced back into normal space or vaporized by a hyperspace flare."
The captain nodded.
"But they're not guarding that approach route," she said slowly. "If we could get through the passageway, we'd be almost assured of a safe voyage to our destination."
"But they might well be keeping an eye on approach routes to the star itself," William mused. "We could be detected then."
"That would prove they had something to hide," Captain Falcone said. She smiled. It lit up her entire face. "There's no point in guarding, let alone mining, the approach routes to a useless red dwarf star. The only reason for having guard ships in place would be to protect a secret, such as a waiting attack fleet." She took a breath. "Inform the crew that we will depart in," she checked her wrist comm, 2 hours from now. "Once we are in hyperspace, we will set course for the Seven Sisters and try to thread the needle."
"Aye, Captain," William said.
She had nerve, he had to admit. There were experienced commanding officers who had been decorated for heroism who would have thought twice about trying to fly through the Seven Sisters, no matter the stakes.
and her family's position wouldn't protect her from hyperspace storms if one lanced out and enveloped their ship. The number of starships that had survived a direct encounter with a hyperspace storm could be counted on the fingers of one hand. "And then contact your friends," she added. "Send them a message, update them on the general situation, and suggest they speed up their preparations."
"Aye, Captain," William said softly. The captain nodded.
"How long do we have?" It was the question William knew. How much did the Theocracy know about what Princess Drusilla had known before making her escape? And did they know she'd been rescued by the Royal Navy? In their place, William would have assumed the worst when their destroyer failed to return. But how long were they prepared to hold out hope before drawing the correct conclusion? The Theocrats had to know that starships could rarely be held to a precise schedule. No one could predict when a hyperspace storm might blow up and push them dozens of light-years off course. He thought, grimly, of the reports from the debriefing. Princess Drusilla hadn't been expected to know anything beyond how to look pretty. All she'd learned had come from sympathetic tutors and a handful of servants, many of whom had been stunningly ignorant themselves of anything more than the basics. The princess could neither read nor write, either in the Theocracy's written language or Galactic Standard English. He honestly didn't know any high-tech world that didn't insist its civilians learn Galactic Standard as a second language. But would the Theocracy expect her to know about their plans? It was hard, very hard, to think like the Theocrats. William had grown up on a world where women were to be protected, but anyone who treated them as property would have rapidly come to regret it. Hebrides bred strong women. Who would want a shrinking violet when the rough environment demanded someone who could do almost anything a man could do? Even now, even with genetic enhancement, his homeworld had never developed a tradition of engineering women for beauty. They preferred strength and stamina. But the Theocrats had considered Princess Drusilla a child. No, worse than a child. They'd considered her property. It was alarmingly possible that they honestly hadn't realized she could think for herself, which might have explained why the princess and her servants had managed to steal a freighter. The security officers had been conditioned not to treat women as serious threats. "There might be an advantage for us in that," he thought, as he saluted and turned to the hatch. "Maybe they won't take a female captain seriously either." Putting the thought to one side, he headed for the bridge. Running through the Seven Sisters would be dangerous. It was time to prepare the crew for the coming ordeal. Chapter 28.
"We are approaching the Seven Sisters," Lieutenant Samuel Wyberg reported. "I estimate we will enter the passageway within 20 minutes.
"Distortion levels are increasing rapidly," Lieutenant Robertson added. "Sensors are at 30% efficiency and failing fast." Kat kept her face impassive with an effort. As a young girl, she'd tried to take up canoeing, only to discover her family forbade her to test herself against any of the really exciting rapids. Now she felt something of the same attraction, mixed with a sick feeling in her gut. Her ship and her crew could be blown to atoms in a second, before they ever knew they were in trouble. And no one would ever find a trace of their remains.
"They'll never see us coming," she thought.
If the navigational data was accurate, they could emerge from the passageway in a haze of distortion, then leave on almost any route they chose. It would require a stroke of very bad luck for any guard ship to see them coming.
"But we might not make it at all."
"Keep us steady," she ordered. She wondered suddenly if she should have updated her will. Her non-voting stocks and shares would be reabsorbed into the family, but her trust fund would be distributed among her former crew, if they survived, and their families.
"Take us into the fire." She linked into the ship's sensors through her implants and recoiled. Giant flashes of lightning cracked through space, each one powerful enough to swat her ship as easily as a human would stamp on an ant. Great, rolling waves of energy blazed round the gravitational shadow cast by Sister Three,
while flickers of energy pulsed between Sister Four and Sister Five. It was a maelstrom far more powerful than anything produced by mankind, Cat knew. No one, despite some proposals, had ever managed to tap hyperspace as a source of energy. All attempts had been universally disastrous. "Look at us," the storms seemed to say. "You puny humans, so smug and secure, you're nothing compared to us." Alerts flashed up in her implants as she disconnected herself from the sensors. Her heartbeat was racing so fast she found sweat trickling down her back. Cat forced herself to take a deep breath, then composed herself with an effort. There was a reason officers and crew were discouraged from peeking through the starship's hull when they were so close to a hyperspace storm. Mentally kicking herself for her mistake, Cat gripped hold of her command chair and braced herself for the first hint of trouble. The hull started to shake gently seconds later.
"Picking up waves of gravity turbulence," Weiberg reported.
The XO leaned forward.
"Can you see the passageway?"
"Yes," Robertson said. "But it's very thin, sir." Cat took a breath. "Take us in," she ordered. "Best possible speed." There was no point in trying to sneak through, she knew. The passage might be safe, at least when compared to the remainder of local hyperspace, but their mere presence would excite hyperspace and trigger more storms. All they could do was race through it as fast as possible and hope they outran any surges of energy chasing them. She studied the display, carefully edited by the computers, to be as unthreatening as possible, then braced herself. The shaking grew worse a moment later.
"Storms are picking up," Robertson reported. "But they're not closing in on us."
The shaking abated, just long enough for Cat to relax. Then it rapidly grew worse. On the display, waves of energy seemed to be spiraling towards them, almost as if the passageway were intelligent and rejecting their very presence. But lightning passed through into the passageway without further incident, finding safe space at the very heart of the storm. It wouldn't last, Cat knew, but she relaxed for a long moment anyway. All she could do was watch and wait. She tracked their progress on the display. They'd be passing closer to Sister Seven than she would have preferred, but it seemed as though the navigational data was largely accurate and the passage was safe. But behind them, storms were gathering. Cat wondered, in a moment of gallows humor, if the Theocracy intended to use the passageway to send their fleet into Commonwealth space. They'd lose at least half of their ships if they tried. Another dull quiver ran through the ship, then a long series of tremors that had Cat bracing herself, praying under her breath in a manner she hadn't used since her first exposure to vacuum back at Piker's Peak. The lights seemed to dim for a second, then came back to life just before something hit the prow of the ship hard enough to shake the entire vessel. Cat felt stunned, then confused, then finally realized they'd rammed right into a gravity wave. A physical impact would have blown the entire ship to bits. "Ramming always works," she thought, remembering lessons at Piker's Peak. "But it's hard to ram when both ships are under power."
"Incoming gravity waves,"
Robertson snapped. Cat snapped out of her trance.
"Brace for impact," she snapped. "All hands, brace for impact."
The hull rang like a bell. Then they were suddenly back in clear space. Behind them, the passageway was thoroughly blocked as storms flashed and flared through the space they'd been only seconds ago. Cat let out a sigh of relief as the shaking rapidly faded away, even though there were still distortions nearby. But it would be almost impossible for anyone to track them through the haze.
"Alter course," she ordered.
"Take us around the distortion, then pick a random course and head into theocratic space." She took a breath. Her uniform was so soaked in sweat that she wanted to change, but she knew there was no time. They might still be unlucky before they put some distance between themselves and the Seven Sisters, and then headed for their target star. She keyed her console, opening the link to engineering. It was several minutes before the engineer replied.
"No major damage, Captain," he reported. "A number of circuit breakers blew, but nothing worse. I have damage control teams replacing them now.
Kat nodded. Energy surges were among the most dreaded effects of hyperspace storms, all the more so as they sometimes materialized in starship systems without any prior warning and wreaked considerable damage.
They'd been lucky, she told herself. Another passage through the Seven Sisters might well be the end of them.
She silently thanked whoever had been crazy, or desperate enough to plot out the course, then turned her attention back to the display. They were pulling away from the Seven Sisters now.
Tactical, she said. Are we in clear space?
As far as I can tell, Roach reported.
He didn't sound happy.
Our sensor range has been cut down quite badly here.
Kat didn't blame him for worrying. If their sensors were unreliable, a theocratic super-dreadnought could be right on top of them and they'd never know about it. The only upside to the whole affair was that the super-dreadnought probably wouldn't see them either, unless the theocracy had produced a major breakthrough in hyperspace sensors. She considered it, then dismissed the thought. If the theocracy could track starships in hyperspace with perfect precision, the war was within shouting distance of being lost before it had even begun.
Alter course, she ordered.
Take us towards our target star, best possible speed.
Aye, Captain, Weiberg said. Estimated ETA 19 hours.
Good, Kat said.
Despite the situation, there was nothing to gain by pushing the drives until they overloaded. She'd only risk stranding her crew in enemy space.
Keep a close eye on the sensors. Assume that every contact is genuine and alter course to avoid detection.
Our course will become quite erratic, the XO warned, and we may be considerably delayed.
Kat nodded. There was no accurate data on shipping lines within the theocracy, but hyperspace had been known to throw up false contacts on a regular basis. It was quite possible they would be delayed. Yet there was no alternative. The last thing she wanted was to have an enemy fleet on her tail because they'd ignored a possible contact until it was too late. She rose to her feet, silently cursing the uniform designers. They'd gone for style, on the theory that every girl loved a spacer, and ignored some of the practicalities. Her shirt simply wasn't absorbing sweat. She wanted a shower, a change, and a nap before they reached the enemy star system. There would be time, at least, to get them.
Mr. XO, you have the bridge, she said. She leaned close so no one else could hear. Make sure you get some rest, too.
Aye, Captain, the XO said.
Kat walked out of the bridge and headed for her cabin, then changed her mind, and went on a walking tour around the ship. Most of her crew, she was gratified to see, looked to have survived their close brush with a hyperspace storm without ill effects, although some looked paler than normal, and a handful had made their way to sickbay for a sedative. Kat was silently relieved the princess and her handmaidens had been offloaded. They would have been terrified by the storm. Then made mental notes to try to ensure her crew got a proper shore leave period as quickly as possible. But she knew it wasn't likely to happen. If the princess had been telling the truth, the war might start alarmingly soon. She finally made her way back to her cabin, then hesitated as she stepped through the hatch and heard it close behind her. It would be easy to call Davidson to her cabin, to invite him to sleep with her. And she knew she needed something to work the tension out of her body. It wasn't like the aftermath of the insurgent attack, when she'd been shaking so badly she wanted someone to hold her to hell with regulations. She could call him. Angrily, she pushed her feelings aside, undressed, and walked right into the washroom. It felt absurdly luxurious, given lightning size compared to a super dreadnought or even a battlecruiser, but for once she was grateful. She showered, dried herself, and then stumbled into bed. It felt as though she hadn't slept at all when the alarm rang, but when she checked her wrist comm, it was clear she'd slept for nearly 18 hours. The whole experience had drained her in a way she hadn't expected.
But you should have expected it, she told herself as she checked the ship's status. They'd only had to change course twice to avoid a potential contact, something that both pleased and worried her. What if they'd missed something?
She had to admit, The Theocracy kept a careful watch on its side of the border, preventing civilian craft from passing without a license and a convoy escort. They wouldn't want to encourage free trade between star systems when that could undermine their position. Or, for that matter, allow refugees to escape. She dressed, then walked back to the bridge. The ship's logs showed that the XO had taken a break, much to her relief, but he'd still managed to be back on the bridge before her. She took her command chair, nodded to him, and concentrated on reviewing the reports from various departments. Thankfully, the storms definitely hadn't left any lingering problems in their wake.
"Captain," Weiberg said, "we are 40 minutes away from our destination."
Kat looked down at her display, thinking hard. The star Princess Drusilla had identified was a red dwarf, largely useless for anything other than secret meetings and hidden colonies, assuming, of course, that it had any planets, asteroids, or comets at all. It was unlikely the Theocracy would go to the expense of mounting dedicated sensor platforms to watch for intruders popping out of hyperspace, not if they had nothing permanent in the system to defend. But a fleet of starships would certainly have their own long-range sensors.
"Take us out at the planned location," she said, finally.
They'd have to crawl into the system just to pick up anything useful, but it would make it harder for any watching passive sensors to detect their arrival. "And then cloak us immediately." She forced herself to relax as the minutes became seconds and then ticked down to zero. Hyperspace roared and seethed, then opened up to allow lightning to slip back into real space, the gateway closing a second later. Kat tensed despite herself as the cloaking device hastily shielded their arrival. It was quite possible that, if there happened to be a guard ship on duty nearby, their arrival would have been detected, no matter what precautions they took. No one had managed to find a way to cloak a starship's arrival from hyperspace.
"Passive sensors are clear," Roach reported. "If there's anything active within engagement range, I can't see it."
Which proves nothing, Kat thought.
Guard ships rarely announced their presence. One of them could be lurking in space, drives and shield deactivated, watching through passive sensors for any uninvited guests.
Or they could be hiding under cloak, watching and waiting for us. She shivered, very slightly, as the ship-mounted passive sensors sucked in data from the nearby system. It seemed almost as barren as the last red dwarf she'd visited, although this time there was a small asteroid field and a handful of comets orbiting the dying star. Someone might have established a hidden colony here, she thought, in the days before the breakaway wars, but there was no way to know. Either they were hiding from the Theocrats or the Theocrats had occupied their colony years ago. Or they'd thought themselves far enough from the UN not to need to hide, and had headed for a G2 star instead. There were three nearby.
"Captain," Roach said, "request permission to deploy the passive sensor arrays."
Kat hesitated.
Admiral Morrison had hemmed and hawed about allowing her to take them, and if she hadn't had her overriding orders from Tyre, she had a feeling he would have refused to allow her to even think about removing the systems from Cadiz.
They were not only staggeringly expensive, but highly classified. Using them in an enemy-held star system ran the risk of having to destroy the arrays rather than bringing them back on board her ship.
"Deploy them," she ordered. She wanted to know as much as she could about the enemy star system before she crept closer. "But be ready to recover them at all times."
Long minutes passed as the systems were deployed, then activated. They were far more capable than starship sensors, she'd been told, although there were limits. Like all passive sensors, they were dependent on their target emitting something that could be tracked. And, unlike lightning's sensors, they could be blinded if something too powerful appeared far too close to them.
"I'm picking up limited drive emissions," Roach said. "They're clustered round the asteroids, Captain. It could be a staging base."
"They'd have to be powerful if we can pick them up from this distance," the XO commented. "Super dreadnoughts, perhaps."
Kat nodded.
"Can you draw more data from the passive arrays?" "I don't think so," Roach said.
He paused, his hands flying over his console.
There are a handful of other drive sources in the system, but most of them are concentrated round the asteroids.
Kat studied the display, then nodded.
Recall the passive arrays, she ordered.
We'll have to go deeper into the system.
We should have brought two ships, she thought, although she knew two ships might not have made it through the passageway. One to sneak close, one to watch from a distance, and run if the shit hits the fan.
Launch probes on ballistic trajectories, she added. Then launch a relay platform to link their laser communicators to us.
Aye, Captain, Roach said.
Kat forced herself to watch as the probes moved into the system, feeling the tension rise as the hours ticked by. The drive sources slowly took on shape and form in the display as lightning followed, her passive sensors watching carefully for anything that might betray the size or capabilities of the enemy starships. Kat swore under her breath as three of them suddenly snapped into view, marked clearly as super dreadnoughts. The UN had never built super dreadnoughts, let alone sold them to the Theocracy. Any doubts she'd had about the Theocracy having its own starship construction program had vanished.
They look larger than ours, the Exo commented.
He didn't sound impressed.
But their drive systems are actually sloppy compared to our ships, and their data nets don't seem to be as capable.
He paused.
But they might have stood them down here, he added. They won't be expecting this system to come under attack, even if we launched a preemptive strike.
Kat knew he had a point, but she hoped the enemy data net was flawed. Super dreadnoughts carried more missile tubes than a whole squadron of heavy cruisers, giving them a formidable long-range punch. While their energy weapons could rip lightning apart at close range, the thought of facing just one of them was worrying. An entire squadron would be frighteningly powerful. And the sensors seemed to indicate that there were at least three entire squadrons of super dreadnoughts holding position near the asteroids. Anything that evened the odds would be more than welcome.
I think they have escort ships, too, Roach said.
New contacts flashed up on the display as lightning moved closer.
A handful of cruisers, several destroyers, and there are definitely some gunboats. I think they're carrying out limited exercises.
Odd, the Exo said. You'd think they'd be interested in exercising as much as possible if they were expecting to go to war. And have more escort ships attached to the fleet.
Kat couldn't disagree. Perhaps they're standing down in preparation for the attack, she said. But then, exercises tended to be more regular than genuine military operations. It was quite possible the enemy's CO was giving his crews a rest. Or... an alarm sounded.
Captain! Roach snapped. They just swept one of the drones!
Chapter 29.
We should be launching the offensive by now, the cleric said. Do you not have authority to launch the attack at the best possible moment?
Admiral Junaid sighed. The cleric had not coped well with his brief imprisonment on the Commonwealth cruiser, even if the authorities on Cadiz had been very apologetic when they'd released the freighter and her crew. Junaid had merely been relieved that he'd been able to leave the system without being interrogated by the Commonwealth, but the cleric had spent most of the return journey performing rituals to cleanse himself after setting foot on an infidel world. At least it had kept the man out of Junaid's beard for a few glorious days.
We do not have the fleet train assembled yet, Junaid said firmly.
It was infuriating. He'd gathered his attack fleet to start the invasion, yet the attack would fail if he wasn't guaranteed resupplies. Commonwealth weapons, assuming any were captured, were not designed to be fired from his ships.
Once the freighters are here, we will take the offensive.
But the infidels caught us, the cleric insisted. They could be preparing their defenses right now.
He was right, Junaid knew, which didn't make him any less irritating. The Commonwealth had caught the spy ship, after all, but they hadn't had any proof. At least, not enough to satisfy their legalistic-minded admiral.
And yet... He recalled the private message from the speaker with a tinge of horror. Who knew what would happen if Princess Drusilla actually made it to Commonwealth space? Shaking his head, he turned back to the display. His spacers and troops hadn't been allowed to grow rusty, even though they'd spent the better part of 3 months orbiting a worthless star. He'd worked them like dogs, forcing them to undergo exercise after exercise, training simulation after training simulation. The crews had responded splendidly, particularly when he'd started offering rewards for best performances. They knew far more about their enemy than the Commonwealth knew about them. There were still too many unanswered questions, though, no matter how many simulations they ran. Would Commonwealth superdreadnoughts be better than theocratic superdreadnoughts? Would the Commonwealth's greater industrial might prove decisive if the early campaigns were unsuccessful? Would the Commonwealth's far wider breadth of research and development give them another advantage? Would the Commonwealth's merchant marines rally behind the flag or flee like frightened children? There were just too many questions nothing but war would be able to answer. He had no doubt the theocracy, or at least the believers who mattered, would be solidly behind the war. Expansion had brought great rewards, after all, along with millions of new converts. But how well would the system endure in a long war? In hindsight, he suspected, they should have built more freighters as well as warships. But anyone who suggested it would have been hauled off to face the Inquisition. The true faith would never allow itself to be defenseless. Not again. They would never allow someone else to determine their fate. The cleric cleared his throat.
"Admiral," he said, "God would not grant us victory if we refuse to take advantage of the opportunities he offers us."
"I know," Junaid said. "But God also expects us not to become too reliant on him." It was the age-old problem, he recalled, that had spurred the growth of the true faith. The older faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, had all been too reliant on God's help and support rather than doing anything to actually earn that support. Their followers had fallen into disbelief and idolatry, resting on laurels that dated back hundreds of years, while their enemies had steadily undermined their positions and prepared them for the kill. In the end, the core of those faiths had died on Earth, but the true faith had survived and prospered. "Of course we did," Junaid thought. "We took nothing for granted." An alarm sounded.
"Report," he snapped.
"Admiral," one of his staffers said, "the outer edge of the spiderweb was just brushed." Junaid swore. He'd thought the spiderweb was a boondoggle, a waste of time and resources that had only been put into production because the designer happened to have powerful family connections. But it seemed it had paid off after all. Unless, of course, it had been brushed by a tiny asteroid. Something so small it had escaped the scans the attack fleet had done of the system when they'd arrived.
"Sensor focus," he ordered. They could use the contact for yet another drill, even if it was nothing more dangerous than another piece of space debris. "Lock on and track the contact, then bring up active sensors. I want space dissected."
"It's a probe," the staffer said. On the display, the contact suddenly came into sharp focus. A probe, Commonwealth design. Moments later, its onboard systems decided there was no hope of escape and triggered the self-destruct.
"Target destroyed. Bring the fleet to battle stations," Junaid ordered. Probes were hardly FTL capable. If one had brushed the edge of his fleet so far from enemy territory, there had to be a mothership out there somewhere, watching them.
His fleet had been located by the enemy.
"Launch gunboats in a search pattern," he ordered. "Then continue to sweep space with active sensors."
He thought it through rapidly. The enemy commander would keep his distance from the fleet, if only to stay out of weapons range, but he couldn't be that far away. Maintaining control of the probe would become harder as the light-speed delay between mothership and probe grew longer and longer. It was just possible the gunboats could catch the enemy ship before she made her escape. And even if they didn't...
"They know we're here," the cleric said.
"Yes," Junaid agreed. The cleric was actually right. Given how little the bastard knew of military strategy, it was a small miracle in and of itself. And there's no reason to be here, apart from staging an invasion of Commonwealth space.
Then we have to take the offensive now, the cleric said, before they manage to warn the Commonwealth.
Junaid nodded. On the display, a red icon representing the enemy ship had just popped into view. The gunboats were already altering course, sweeping towards their new target. But it didn't take more than a glance to tell him they wouldn't intercept their target unless the enemy commander decided to wait around for them. It wasn't likely to happen.
Inform the fleet that we will be departing in an hour, he ordered, and then power up the Starcom. We need to alert our operatives that the war is about to begin.
He took a breath. Years of careful planning and preparation were about to face their first true test, as was the theocracy itself. Every previous conquest had been largely unable to defend itself, not against a pair of destroyers taking the high orbitals. But the Commonwealth was heavily defended, a multi-star political system with its own ideology that might well undermine the theocracy's control over its population, given time. Even if expansion hadn't been one of the tenets of the revised true faith, Junaid suspected there would have been war. The galaxy simply wasn't big enough for both of them. It wasn't going to be easy, he knew. There would be a delay in offensive operations, a delay that could prove costly. But there was no alternative. If they let the moment pass, the enemy might have an opportunity to prepare to meet the oncoming storm. And that could prove disastrous. We have to win quickly, he told himself, or we may not win at all. He pushed the thought aside. Defeat was unthinkable.
They caught the probe, Roach said. Their fleet is coming to battle stations now.
Cat nodded. Dozens of starships were bringing up their active sensors, revealing their positions to her sensors. The enemy fleet was bigger than they'd thought, although it was still strikingly light in escort ships. Perhaps they'd crammed more point defense into their super dreadnoughts than she'd realized, she wondered. Or perhaps they'd simply concentrated on super dreadnoughts to the exclusion of all else. The display washed red, just for a second.
They caught us, Roach added.
The display turned red again. This time the color refused to fade.
I think they have a solid lock on our position.
Crap, the XO commented.
Do they have something new?
Roach looked down at his console.
I think they ramped up standard sensors, he said after a moment's thought. I don't think they've got anything new, sir.
But you could be wrong, Cat thought. They're not stupid. They might have developed something we missed. She pushed the thought aside as red icons separated themselves from the enemy fleet and raced towards Lightning's position. Gunboats. She cursed under her breath, remembering tactical analysis reports that suggested the theocracy had no gunboats. Clearly, someone had dropped the ball somewhere. Cat wasn't particularly surprised. Even if the theocracy's scientists hadn't come up with the idea for themselves, they'd have no trouble stealing it from the Commonwealth or one of the other independent powers.
Gunboats will enter engagement range in 5 minutes, Roach warned.
Cat thought fast. They'd already learned more than she'd expected to learn, and more than she'd wanted to learn about the enemy fleet. There could be no doubt of its objective, not now. The only logical reason to mass a fleet round a useless star, where it couldn't hope to defeat an inhabited planet, was to prepare to mount an invasion of enemy space. Even exercises could be carried out in a populated star system.
Helm, take us out of here, she ordered.
An engagement with enemy gunboats might prove disastrous, depending on what weapons they carried. Ship-killer missiles would rip Lightning apart if they were launched from very close range.
And then set course for the border, maximum speed.
Aye, Captain,
Wyberg said.
I'm picking up drive emissions from the enemy's super dreadnoughts, Roach said. They're powering up their drives.
Cat exchanged a glance with her XO. They hadn't just found proof of the imminent offensive. They'd triggered it. She had tried to warn the XO's friends and allies on Seventh Fleet, But would they be ready to fight when the theocracy arrived? Somehow Kat couldn't help feeling as though disaster was about to unfold. It was vaguely possible the offensive wasn't about to begin. She shook her head angrily. That was wishful thinking, and she knew it.
They've lost the element of surprise, she thought. But if they act fast, they can still give us a pounding before we're ready to meet them.
Vortex opening,
Weiberg said. Behind them, the enemy gunboats broke off as it became clear they wouldn't be able to catch lightning.
We are gone.
Take us to the border, Kat ordered as the eerie lights of hyperspace enfolded her starship.
Don't worry about stealth, just get us to Cadiz as fast as you can, she thought, rapidly.
Thankfully, they did have some advantages. The enemy might give chase, but it was unlikely they could get a ship into hyperspace fast enough to actually track her ship before she put enough distance between them to be effectively invisible. But then they'd have no real doubt of her destination. Cadiz was still the closest Commonwealth world with a starcom. Once she reached Cadiz, she could scream a warning that would outrace any theocratic attack fleets. But the first invasion fleet would be hard on her heels.
Assuming they're not pushing their drives to the limit, she thought, how long would it take them to reach Cadiz?
She played with tactical simulations on the display, but the solutions changed, depending on the variables she entered. If the theocracy pushed its drives to the limit, there was a good chance they'd reach Cadiz within 17 hours, just after Lightning's own arrival. But if they decided not to risk burning out their drives within enemy territory, they'd take around 20 hours to reach Cadiz, giving the defenders several hours to prepare for the attack. It wouldn't be enough.
We might run into a guard ship, the XO warned, or a minefield.
We have to take the risk, Kat answered. We don't have time to try to sneak back through the Seven Sisters. She gritted her teeth. One day, she told herself, someone would invent an FTL communicator small enough to be mounted on a heavy cruiser, one that would save future ships from having to flee with the forces of hell snapping at their heels. It was possible, in theory, to mount one on a super dreadnought, but as Starcom units were staggeringly expensive and power-intensive, it was unlikely anyone would try. The Commonwealth had preferred to establish a single Starcom in orbit round each of its populated worlds. God alone knew what the Theocracy had done with their Starcoms. But the XO was right. They might well run into a minefield if they weren't careful, although part of her suspected the Theocracy might have disabled its own mines in preparation for the invasion. Mines weren't known for being good at telling the difference between friendly and unfriendly targets, particularly in hyperspace. IFF signals were dangerously unreliable in hyperspace, after all. It was one of the reasons the Commonwealth had never bothered to mine even rarely used hyper routes.
That might cost us now, she thought grimly. The Theocracy will have free rein to move through hyperspace to our worlds.
Prepare messages for your allies, she ordered grimly. Tell them that time is about to run out. She reached for her terminal and started to compose a message to the Admiralty. If it had the right priority tags, it would be bumped right to the top of the queue for processing and transmitting as soon as they reached Cadiz. The Admiral would be informed, of course, but he wouldn't be able to stop the message. She attached the raw sensor recordings to a follow-on message, then pulled up the records and started to study them, hoping to draw something from the raw data. But she knew it would take a team of analysts to parse the data successfully. The only hopeful sign was a suggestion that enemy data nets were nowhere near as capable as the Commonwealth's systems, and she knew better than to take that for granted. It was equally possible the enemy systems had merely been stepped down.
Captain, Roach said, we may have an enemy contact.
Kat looked at the display. A yellow icon had appeared.
Not quite blocking their path to Cadiz, but alarmingly close. There was no way to tell if it was a warship, a smuggler, or simply a glitch in the sensors. But surely even the most paranoid guard ship wouldn't be expecting a heavy cruiser hightailing it out of theocratic space.
Keep us on course, she ordered. If they come within engagement range, prepare to open fire without further warning.
Aye, Captain, Roach said. Kat forced herself to relax. She'd done all she could. All they could do now was keep running to Cadiz,
and pray to God they got there in time. She accessed her implants, then linked directly to Davidson. I want you to carry a message to the CO on the ground, she sub-vocalized. He needs to be informed that his garrison may come under heavy attack.
Understood, Davidson said.
There was a pause.
Do you want to disembark my company?
I don't know, Kat said, honestly. If Cadiz was about to come under attack, the defenders would need all the help they could get. But unless the situation was better than she thought, she would be sending Davidson and his men to certain death.
Do you believe it's necessary?
They'll need support, Captain, Davidson said. He sounded solidly confident, although he rarely sounded excited or nervous. And there is a planetary defense center on the surface. The bastards couldn't just flatten the planet from orbit.
Not all of it, Kat thought. But the insurgents would probably tip the scales against the Commonwealth garrison. Poor bastards.
Leave one platoon of Marines on the ship, Kat ordered. You may deploy the remainder of your force to the surface.
She hoped, as she closed the channel, that she hadn't made a deadly mistake.
Admiral Junaid listened absently as the cleric harangued his men, telling them of the virtues of fighting the infidel and the rewards each man could expect if he died in combat against the theocracy's deadliest foe. Thankfully, the cleric was smart enough not to insist the men drop everything to listen, particularly as the fleet was readying itself for departure. He merely spoke through the communications network, trusting that those who had no immediate tasks would listen. Junaid allowed himself a tight smile. They might have been caught by surprise, but the crews had responded very well. It had been barely 50 minutes since the enemy craft had vanished into hyperspace, but his ships and crews were ready to depart already. He'd sent messages to the homeworld, warning of the outbreak of war, and messages into the Commonwealth, activating sleeper cells that had been waiting for the command to move. By the time his fleet entered enemy territory, they would already have given the Commonwealth a bloody nose. And then there would be the declaration of war. The Commonwealth would have some warning, he knew. Their spy ship had made certain of that. But it wouldn't be enough to make a difference. The hammer was about to come down hard.
Admiral, his ops officer said, the fleet is ready to depart.
Junaid smiled again. Then open the vortex, he ordered. There was no longer any time for doubt and uncertainty, merely victory. And set course for Cadiz.
Chapter 30 Lieutenant Jacob Moreland was shaking so hard as he walked into the Starcom control center that he was surprised the security officers didn't pull him aside for questioning. It was his fault, he knew, and he would have deserved nothing less than arrest and imprisonment for being so weak. But he didn't have the nerve to turn himself in and confess everything. Instead, he knew he would do as he'd been told, one final time. He'd been bored on Cadiz. He'd moved between the giant Starcom and the spaceport, seeing nothing of the planet outside the walls and seeking what solace he could in the facilities on the ground. They'd managed to get their hooks into him there, he recalled. First, they'd helped him get into debt, then manipulated him into doing small tasks for them in exchange for payment. And then it had been too late to back out, confess all, and escape unscathed. He'd been too deeply committed for surrender. The giant control center held over a dozen operators, each of them responsible for checking and vetting messages sent from Cadiz to Tyre and the rest of the Commonwealth. He sat down at his console, then pressed his hand against the scanner, allowing it to identify him and confirm his access permissions. There was a long pause, just long enough for him to hope the system had developed problems. Then a line of messages streamed up in front of him. He couldn't help noticing that most of the messages were civilian. Military traffic was handled by another section. He reached into his pocket and removed the data chip. It looked absurdly common, just like any other commercial data chip capable of storing 1 billion terabytes of data. There were trillions in existence, he knew,
so many that no one would think anything of an officer carrying one or two in his pocket. It could have held anything from personal messages from home to his private collection of porn. But instead, it had come from his masters, from the men who had ruined his life. Whatever it held, he was sure it wasn't something as unremarkable as porn.
"You will insert the chip into the command system," his contact had said.
They'd met in one of the more extreme brothels, where the more exotic tastes were satisfied.
"And then you will activate the chip."
Jacob swallowed, wondering if he dared accidentally lose the chip. But he knew it would result in his betrayal or death. He'd crossed too many lines already. No one would ever look the same way at him if they knew what he'd done. He would be lucky if he was only dishonorably discharged, then dispatched to Nightmare as an involuntary exile. Bracing himself, he took the chip and pushed it into the console. A screen popped up requesting permission to run the chip. Jacob hesitated, knowing there was no going back now, then keyed his command code into the console. The chip activated without further delay. Nothing happened. For nearly an hour, as far as he could tell. Then all hell broke loose. The Starcom pulsed signals across space with the assistance of a singularity, held within powerful force fields at the center of the massive structure. Now, with terrifying speed, the singularity destabilized, and then fell back into the quantum foam as safety systems activated, trying to prevent a disaster. Alarms howled in the control center as data links to Tyre, Marigold, and the other worlds that made up the Commonwealth collapsed, isolating Cadiz from the remainder of the network. It would take weeks, Jacob realized numbly, to purge the command and control system of the rogue software and then generate another singularity. Until then, Cadiz was cut off from the network. The authorities caught up with Jacob within an hour. But by then it was far too late.
"Transmit the signal," Cat ordered as lightning burst back into normal space. They'd jumped out of hyperspace far too close to the planet for comfort, but she'd seen no other choice. "And then get me a secure link to the Admiral."
There was a long pause.
"Captain," Ross said, "the Starcom network is down."
Cat blinked.
"Locked out?"
"No, Captain," Ross said. "They've lost the singularity."
"Shit," the Exo said. "It could take weeks to recreate the singularity."
Cat couldn't disagree. Everything she'd been taught about singularities said that creating one was an incredibly finicky task. First, they had to produce the gravity well itself, then set it to resonate with the rest of the interstellar communications network. The Exo was right. It could take weeks of fine-tuning before Cadiz was back in touch with the rest of the Commonwealth. By then the Theocracy would have hammered Seventh Fleet into the ground.
"Find a courier boat," she ordered.
There were always one or two commercial couriers in the system, even though their owners should have had access to the Starcom. Some information was just too sensitive to be placed on the network.
"Hire him. Then transmit a copy of our records and order him to fly directly to the next working Starcom."
The XO gave her a look.
"Captain," he said slowly, "what if the entire network is down?"
Cat swallowed. It took 3 weeks for a starship to travel from Cadiz to Tyre. If the entire network was down, the war was within shouting distance of being lost before it had even fairly begun. The Theocracy's commanders would be able to exercise a degree of command and control the Commonwealth's officers would not be able to match. But she knew enough about the network to be fairly sure it couldn't just be taken down as easily as a commercial data net. The system had multiple redundancies built in everywhere.
"Then we're in trouble," she said grimly.
She rose.
"Contact your friends and warn them of the oncoming storm. I'll speak to the Admiral in my ready room."
"Aye, Captain," the Exo said.
Cat took a breath as she stepped through the hatch and sat down at her desk, then waited for Admiral Morrison to answer the call. She'd hoped they could reach Cadiz ahead of any enemy force, and it seemed likely they'd succeeded. But she hadn't anticipated losing the Starcom. and yet, in hindsight, it was the obvious move. The Theocracy could have sent their own signal ahead of Lightning, warning their operatives to move at once. And they